This is Frank Prattle. You're listening to WPS1 Art Radio, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate. My name is Zephyr Thrall. I'm inside the belly of the beast, the very heart nerve center of Democracy in America, the national campaign, the new hit show by Creative Time here in the Park Avenue Armory. It so happens that I have the two top, I would say, stars of the show.
We like top dogs better.
Top dogs. The honchos, Nato Thompson, the curator, and Ann Pasternak, the president and artistic director of Creative Time. Hello.
Hey there.
Welcome.
How are you guys?
Awesome.
Great.
So we're midway through. We're waist level in this fantastic show that's got both good press, bad press, and tons of people have visited. How do you guys feel so far?
I feel great. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah?
The belly of the beast is full of clamor and excitement.
So, you know, I got to tell you something. I actually feel more than great. I feel profoundly grateful because I have a hell of a time reading news headlines these days and turning on the television to watch news. And I get just so tired by the limitations of how information is shared in this country. So being immersed for the past week in artists' thoughts, considerations, doubts, hopes has been an incredible blessing in my life and a really important time to immerse oneself, at least myself, in this kind of inquiry.
One of the questions that I have is that this show is definitely a show on the different, I would say, petals of the flower of democracy. And one of the critiques has been that it's all been fairly left-leaning. How do you guys respond to that?
Well, I mean, this word left is so strange to me. I have difficulties unpacking it. It's like when you hear the idea of the liberal media. I'm never clear what that means either. If it means that people are concerned about basic issues of, say, healthcare, prisons, immigration,
women's rights, gay rights, education, poverty.
I mean, I guess if being concerned about every issue of social justice in the country is left, so be it. But I think the answers that are provided are more complex than some sort of simplistic binary opposition. So that's kind of how I feel about politics in general, and that is definitely reflected in the work here.
And in fact, Nato, you curated the show so that it wasn't partisan and it wasn't election-oriented. And in fact, you know, for the folks who see it as left-leaning, you know, if such a construct exists, the truth of the matter is that many of the artists in the show give it to all political parties, that nobody is spared any grace.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, I think most of the artists that come to the table have a very complex understanding of politics that go beyond Republican, Democrat, or even government in and of itself. The span of what constitutes politics is the span of what constitutes one's life, and that's what artists bring to the table, not just artists, people. And I think that's what makes this show so fun and interesting and difficult and enjoyable, is this ability to address the complicated situation that we live in the richness of dialogue that it deserves.
One of the questions that I have walking around is it's an incredibly varied show. How many artists do you guys have?
About 40.
40 spread out over, you know, three huge floors plus a giant drill hall, you know, the size of a, you know, Olympic swimming pool or something like that. You know?
Yeah.
And in this amount of activity humming in one place, what have been kind of some of the standouts that you guys have seen?
Well, in terms of
not to choose favorites.
No, it wouldn't be to choose favorites, but there's a few, you know, just to kind of backtrack in terms of how the show is comprised. We've also went across the country and commissioned projects. We had Sharon Hayes, who did this incredible project called Revolutionary Love 1 and 2, I'm Your Best Fear, I'm Your Worst Fantasy at the Republican National Convention, the Democratic National Convention. That piece is extraordinarily powerful. But we also have Mark Tribe's Port Huron project showing videos of new left speech reenactments. Steve Powers' Waterboard Thrill Ride. Olga Kumenduras and Rodney McMillan's News from a Mime Stud. These pieces, it must be understood, we went across the country and commissioned them and are addressing specific political issues. So it's, you know, I like to think of it as like a plane landing. In a sense, we got to show the work from around the country here, including also the mobile project, the Ice Cream Truck by Center for Tactical Magic, Valerie Tavarian, Angel Navarro's protest karaoke that was in the boroughs outside of Manhattan, so Prospect Park, Flushing Meadows, Corona Park. The ability to get outside of the bubble of Manhattan has been really interesting. That's something people can see here. Then you have the flip side, which is what, you know, your group Red 76 is here holding discussions. Incubate is cooking soup and holding discussions. There's also this participatory quality that is the daily life of here. And the speeches in the night are so riveting. So it's, you know, taking these kind of projects that were documented beyond and then giving them a home that is a social space, a context, is kind of the, I guess, the gumbo, if you will, that makes this kind of political dynamic really hum.
And, you know, I have to say, when we were working on conversations with artists around the country and these national projects, we didn't have the idea of creating an exhibition. It wasn't until we were walking through the space and thought, geez, you know, this is the most decorated armory in the entire country. It was built by the likes of, you know, the Carnegies and the Mellons and those and the Astors, those kinds
and
of folks.
And the Vanderbilts.
And the Vanderbilts, yeah. The Tiffany Rooms, yeah. Et cetera. It's an incredible place that in its context deals with economic power, military power. And it seemed to make a lot of sense to do something about democracy in this space. And rather than, you know, selecting, which would have been a fine thing to do, a lot of blue chip name recognizable artists, what you have here are a lot of artists who are completely under the radar. You know, people, you know, very special group of people who are really interested in more grassroots and artist-centered and artist collaboration kinds of efforts know about Red 76 or Incubate. But I would say it's probably fair to say that the mainstream art world of New York, it's very market-centered art world, doesn't necessarily know. And to have these more grassroots kinds of energies and efforts and programs going on is something that really exercises a kind of democracy within the space that is not part of its normal history. And I think that juxtaposition is really, really interesting for us. And that's been a great surprise for me, actually.
Yeah, that's been really fun.
Yeah.
One of the things walking around New York right now, and you know, actually just a second ago we were looking at the front of the New York Times, and there's, you know, pictures of Obama, pictures of McCain, pictures of our fearless leader George Bush, all of that, you know, just this kind of pressure cooker of politics right now. And, you know, you're on the subway, you hear people talking about, you know, well, did you hear that shit about, you know, he's not going to debate, he's not going to debate, and, you know, and then you hear little clip snips elsewhere, you know, and everybody seems to be abuzz with this kind of political machine right now.
Do you know, actually it's interesting you say that, because this morning when I was on the train, and I think it's because of the economy, not because of politics, but I saw more people reading newspapers this morning on the train than I've ever seen before. Mm.
Really?
Yep. Mm. But I interrupted you, Ice.
No,
I apologize.
No. That in the middle of this fervor, this, you know, this kind of feast of politics, that you guys are taking a truly a different angle to it, one that is one that, you know, I'd consider quite admirable as well, that kind of reactivates people not on a shit-talking level, not on a, you know, he said this, she said that, who's going to win, but rather, what can I do? And tell me a little bit about that and how you went about choosing artists.
Well, first of all, I think to go back to these town hall talks we held, which was, we went to 5 cities, I worked with this guy, Daniel Tucker, does this magazine in Chicago called Area. But we held these talks with artists that consider their work activists, and this was in Baltimore, New Orleans, Chicago, New York, and L.A. And we tried to really bridge a lot of demographics, you know, so mural movements, youth media, spoken word poetry were brought to the table in an effort to find forms that spoke to different communities. Contemporary art has a community, but also so does spoken word poetry, and so demographics change depending on the form, and being aware of that. But what became very evident very quickly in doing this project, that project, was that a lot of artists have, you know, after the anti-globalization movement has kind of petered out after 9/11 in this country, a lot of people started focusing on local issues, prisons, gentrification, immigration. That came up a lot. And what was interesting about it is, while a lot of people worried about why don't artists work against the war, why isn't there this giant movement against the war, the one thing that isn't addressed is there's a war on the people in America that isn't being addressed. And I say that only in so much as people are reacting to things that are immediately affecting their lives. You know, displacement, job insecurity. These are the forces that are making artists work together and collaborate and work more like grassroots models than individual practitioners. This show is an effort to both bring that kind of sensibility to the fore, but also, you know, make that argument a little more evident for people, right? That in fact politics are happening to you. And so when we have these collaboratives, if you will, Or a lot of these artists are friends to some degree or another all across the country. There's this looseness infrastructure that's out there, that's functional. The speakers that speak here, a lot of them have tangential relationships with these communities. I guess in a way it's tightening up that machine and making it evident that these aren't just some sort of lost artworks or lost communities, but a massive community across the country.
And putting focus on it, putting a spotlight on it.
Yeah. Now, one of the things, you know, then this is kind of a bit tangential, but, you know, we'll get there, is when I was 18, I was a bit idealistic, you know, and still am. But I joined the Socialist Party.
Yeah.
And one of the things that the American Socialist Party tells you at your first meeting when you sit down is that you now have an FBI file on you. Congratulations. Like, across the board, they open FBI files on all the socialists. And I went to a meeting last night here where there was a speaker talking about the RNC, the Republican National Convention, and talking about Eyewitness, a group that goes around and they film police action, you know, at different demonstrations. Nonviolent, they just sit there with cameras on the cops. And that led to a larger conversation about what the government might be doing, in fact, about this show.
Right.
And so I had a question, if you guys have felt any heat, you know, both locally from police or city organizations, or nationally from, you know, any kind of larger organization such as the FBI, etc.
None, but I am expecting I'll be audited this year.
Yeah, there's the first sign of heat. Well, you know, I mean, to be quite frank, talking to artist Trevor Paglen, for example, someone that a lot of people ask, aren't you afraid for your life? To what degree can one expose governmental secrets like this, right, when your task is to expose the thing that's supposed to be kept hidden?
Right.
And his answer is, you know, at some point your outrage has to go beyond your own safety. And not to say that Crave Time is like going beyond its own safety. Clearly it's about, but like what I mean to say is his outrage politically is justifiable. And he's managed to do this quite fine. Also, when I was at Mass MoCA with the Interventionist show and we had the FBI confiscate one of the works of art, we had no pressure from the government ever, because I also think that I think this kind of pressure heat that you might think exists on the macro level is very wary of culture. And also, you have a group like, for example, the Yes Men, right, who want heat because nobody can win, because they just take that heat and put it back in the spotlight.
Right, right.
I think that people are pretty sensitive to, you know, being very careful about how one applies pressure, because, you know, ultimately, we have a platform to discuss political issues. And I think people just kind of leave that alone.
But, you know, beside that, what we're doing should not be exceptional. Right. I mean, that's the outrage, if there's any outrage. It's not that we're doing a show that shows truly how much we love this country and love each other and love this world by discussing our beliefs in democracy. What is an outrage, or should be an outrage, is that more people in our field aren't doing this. They're the ones who should be audited, not us.
Did you hear that? Did you, do you sense, you know, you go to kind of parallel organizations, or maybe even more institutional organizations, such as, you know, your MoMAs, your Whitneys, your Guggenheims, people like that, your larger fish. Do you think that they're steering away from politics? Do you think that that people are kind of coming more into this stream now, or is it a taboo subject?
Listen, I think it's been very hard for major cultural institutions to engage in the kind of exhibition and project that NATO is engaged here. I think ever since the Cultural Wars, there's this outrageous notion that somehow or other there's an idea of a political art. I happen to be one of those people that believes all great art is political. Which is a whole nother subject, but I think that there's this idea that somehow art that's political is didactic and one-liner and unimportant and not timely, and I just don't see that, and I think actually that this show proves quite otherwise. But nonetheless, with the lack of public funding in this country and the increasing reliance on corporate support and private support, institutions feel either a real or imagined pressure to stay away from these kinds of topical subjects.
Right.
And so it is more of an exception rather than a rule when they take on something that's more topical and challenging.
Right.
And we know this from tons of evidence, and some of it evidence in this show, that there's a tremendous amount of self-censorship within educational and cultural institutions these days.
And I just add too, I mean, what we're doing here is really important on an infrastructural level, that is to say the kind of economies or spaces that produce exhibitions. Because when you lead by example, you know, by doing projects like this, and I've seen this happen many times, when people see it work and they're like, oh my gosh, it's okay to do this, it seems that obvious, you will see other institutions do it.
Not only is it okay, it's inspiring.
It is inspiring, right? Yeah. When people see it work. For example, I could say that when we were in Oakland with the Oakland Museum of California doing the Angela Davis speech reenactment, we partnered with the Oakland Museum of California and really brought a lot of ex-Black Panthers and their kids out to West Oakland to see this reenactment of the Angela Davis speech. And there was tons of people there. And all these efforts at education, how do you reach out to the community, you know, these kind of esoteric anxieties that all institutions have, seemed all of a sudden very solvable and very simple. And I think when institutions see things work, I always joke that, you know, relevance helps audience come, right? Like relevance to people's lives might not be such a bad idea in terms of audience development and outreach and everything. But when they see it, when people see it work, they go, oh, and it's really amazing to watch.
I think it's important to say too that we did have institutional partners in this show, and we were very, very honored to be able to work with them. We worked with the Blanton Museum in Austin and the Oakland Art Museum in Oakland, California, LACE in Los Angeles, the Walker Art Museum in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and the list goes on. We had some really fantastic partners, and so it shows too that there are cultural institutions within this country that are still willing to take these kinds of so-called risks.
I also say I think a lot of curators are super lazy. I mean, I think like the reason, I mean, only so much is they don't really like, I always joke that there's like blue chip curators. They just look at the market and watch what goes up and then they put their money.
Take a trip to Chelsea and then come back.
Yeah, but they really just do it because, you know, the market at least has a number that shows what has value.
Right, right.
So you don't have to risk something much more vulnerable, which is your own thoughts that don't have numbers associated.
And your own reputation.
And your own reputation.
And it's easier for the institution to raise funding for artists that are already tried and true.
Yeah, that's right, because it's a sure bet. And it makes sense. But like that, it always, you know, you go to some institutions, I'm not just saying, you know, like I don't want to point at anybody, I just feel like you, as every art goer knows, sometimes you go to shows and you're like, how hard was this to curate? Oh. You know, you could flip the pages of the ads in Art Forum and you'd get it.
Right.
Ring, hey, I got a show.
Yeah.
So I think like, and there's a tendency for that, but it's not smart curating, it's bad curating. I think it's an anxiety because we live in a very complicated field where there aren't masters anymore. There's tons of different styles. It's all over the place. It's really hard to know where to go. And I think some people defer to the market as a space of truth.
Well, we are living in the heart of capitalism in the United States.
Yes.
So, I mean, some of that, I suppose, is defensible, but not a lot of it.
Fair enough.
One of the things we were talking about a little bit earlier that I definitely wanted to touch on was politics versus culture and what that means when you're talking about not only voting, but living and also making an art show.
Well, first of all, it's interesting that I hate political art as a term. I've never liked it. I always like the idea of content, right? I'm just content driven. Mm-hmm. And that means it's not always about elections or voting or anything like that. You know, everybody's experience in the world is political, like Ann said. So content is what we're interested in here.
Right.
Now, when people say, oh my gosh, you know, how is political art in right now? And how does that matter to the elections? I always think, well, there's the left or the progressive, you know, the Democrats, you know, that little slippery slope, whatever you call it, still has this modernist notion. They're trapped in the idea that the average American will pile up the facts based on each candidate, and they will decide what's in it for them, right?
Right.
And of course, you have these great quandaries about why is it that the working class of America votes for the neoconservative policies that will make them poorer, right? There's this riddle. Well, the answer is because your methodology understanding the world is wrong. That in fact, we live in a post-Fordist age, a information economy age, where the main product of America is culture. And people deploy that, i.e. Karl Rove, strategically to produce a sense of belonging in the world, in a deeply alienating world, that makes people do things. And what I mean by that is people vote based on culture, affinities, who they relate to, who speaks to their anxieties in the world. And that's why people really get excited about Sarah Palin, because, you know, and that's why religion fills the space of faith for a lot of people. That really makes people vote. So culture, that is culture. That is the manipulating of semiotics or information to make the world happen. That's what artists are doing. They're playing that game. So when artists take on the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, they're trying to manipulate that visual language to produce the real internal truths of it. But it's also what's made people very cynical about political art, because often people say, you're just doing that to make lots of money, right?
Right.
The kind of, it's not really about what you say it's about. It's about your own career.
It's about exploiting the situation for career
purposes. And we see this more and more. You know, everyone's very confused. What's the intention behind this work? Why isn't this, how can this be political? This is about you making Creative Time more famous, or you making, you know, like with Paul Chan, New Orleans. You're just using New Orleans to make Creative Time famous. Or you're just, and you know what? This is a real tendency. I mean, but this is an anxiety about not knowing how to read culture anymore. This is the trap that political artists are in. Right.
Well,
this is the trap we as a society are in.
I mean, then you get artists such as, you know, people who are traditionally known for like street art and things like that, such as your Shepherd Fairies, who go off and make Obama posters and things like that, where it could definitely be argued that you're using that for your own career. I mean, you do have the validity to that as well. You know what I mean?
No. I totally know it's the case.
Okay.
I mean, it is the case that people use political content for commercial purposes.
Yes.
I mean, I always joke that the most me and Mark Beasley at Creative Time always joke like, hey, let's do a show that no institutional touch, a graffiti show, because of its inherent subversiveness. Because like graffiti books just sell off the racks.
Right.
It's the most capitalist friendly genre to some degree.
Right.
At least in terms of books.
Right.
So it's like, you know, this idea that graffiti is inherently subversive. Surely things like Urban Outfitters pose some problems to them.
So I'm going to ask you guys then, in this you know, pillar, this ziggurat of free speech that you guys have developed here on 66th and Park, and you have soapboxes across the place. I mean, there's more soapboxes than people occasionally here, although there have been a hell of a lot of people here. No. What
have you listened to the soapbox speak on its own?
Yes, the quiet song. What the hell do you want to say? Ann Pasternak, what are you dying to say? What do you want to stand on a soapbox and tell people?
I think my moment of passion right now is about how education, public education in this country has really failed us. And until education is seriously improved on a family level and a public school level, we won't have informed voters. And we'll keep making drastically tragic mistakes that have profound ramifications on people's lives here nationally as well as internationally.
That's awesome.
NATO? Well, you know, I guess what I'd like to say is I think they're incredible. I think actually there is a whole movement of art that's out there. Artists that are very aware of the complications of cultural commodification that's existing and are producing social networks that are like a slow burn, that work slowly over time, just like your group Red 76, but there's hundreds of them in this country and beyond. And that I think that infrastructure that's latent needs to reach out to communities that aren't specifically contemporary art, but are broader demographically and are very hungry for change. I think the groundwork for real social change in this country is growing and is there, and we should just kind of work to tighten it up and make it functional.
I love that.
Can we get a collective high five?
High five!
You're listening to Art Radio, WPS1. This show is called Frank Prattle. You can listen at www.wps1.org or frankprattle.com. My name is Zephyr Thrall, and I am not the only member of Red 76, by the way. Sam Gould is the founding head honcho, as well as Gabriel Mendel Solomon, I believe it is. He changes his last name occasionally.
Yeah.
And my special guests today have been the kick-ass duo, NATO Thompson, the curator of Democracy in America, the national campaign, and Ann Pasternak, the president and artistic director of Creative Time. Thank you both so much.
It was great to be here.
Thanks.
Thank you.